I've been reading tonight, Thinking by Machine by Pierre de Latil. Here to discuss the book are Norbert Wiener, professor of mathematics, MIT, and Isaac Asimov, associate professor of biochemistry, Boston University School of Medicine. Your I've Been Reading host is P. Albert Duhamel, Phil Mathia professor in the English department, Boston College.
Well, Professor Wiener, I imagine that most people reading the title of this book, Thinking by Machine, are going to leap to one unforgivable conclusion, probably also a confusion. Namely, this book is all about the wonderful automatic calculators, is it?
I would say that it takes its origin from the automatic calculators. That represents the earliest phase of the work, but I think the chief merit of Pierre de Latil's book is that it goes definitely beyond that, and it presents an introduction to the general problem of organization, both that of organization that's already been planned and constructed in detail, programmed in detail, and the newer problems of organizations which to a certain extent have to program themselves, so that it goes well beyond that.
Generally speaking, Professor Asimov, won't you agree, it's a book about cybernetics, something of which we know nothing, it's a vague subject which usually provides material for science fiction writers. Isn't that all it does?
Well, by a curious coincidence, you strike on a subject in which I know something. And this is rather difficult to do, mostly. However, in science fiction, we have indeed done a great deal with cybernetics. But in speaking to Dr. Wiener, it seems to me we'll have to race a little to stay ahead of the science, or at least reasonably ahead of the science. For one thing, in science fiction, the thinking machine has as its highest goal, usually, the approach to the human mind itself. And this, I now understand, is not necessarily at all the highest approach of the machine. You were saying something about that, Dr. Wiener,
yes.
And I wish you would repeat it.
I was saying that the machine can be regarded from two points of view. One is a machine that is already fully programmed, where the imitation of the human mind is fed into it by a specific wiring diagram, where the machine does not organize itself, and such a machine is already reaching its limitations. That is, the problem of programming such a machine is itself a thing that needs some automatization. Now, the next stage is to make a machine which, in some sense, programs itself. That means learns. Now, there are various levels of learning. The learning itself may be highly programmed. You may have different orders of learning. But what you want is a machine which, in some sense, will work itself in by its own experience from a more or less random organization. That idea has been approached by Ashby, and there are other people following in that direction. This represents a real need.
I suppose most people thinking of a machine that organizes itself might think of some of these machines that have been devised to play chess, or I imagine play checkers. Is that a good example of such a machine?
It could be, because there are several stages of such a machine. Now, the first order of a chess-playing machine is one where the general policy programming has been fed in completely from the beginning. Well, that cannot change itself. If you were playing such a machine, you would have the experience of playing against a rigid personality which cannot learn, cannot change, but can act competently within its frame. By the way, if you are playing a machine, you are playing a personality. You must see that if you remember that if you are playing a game of correspondence chess, the chess is all that you know of the personality that you're playing. Now, however, supposing that your machine has its programming dependent on the actual past experience of games that it has played. Such a machine, then, would be a different machine to a certain extent according to the previous games it had played. And therefore, you would deal not only with a personality, but with a personality you felt to be a growing personality.
Professor Asimov, is there a plot for a science fiction, let's say a man discovering he's been playing a machine all the time by correspondence?
Well, I can think offhand of a variation of that. That is, one has a machine which, for one reason or another, has gone out of order. And the problem is then to deduce in what way it has gone out of order and how it may be brought back into order. Now, Dr. Wiener would settle it by having it self-controlled so that it brings itself back into order, but that removes the the plot, the suspense, everything else.
Of course, there is one thing. People often have the idea that because a machine performs, it must perform perfectly. That isn't necessary. I mean, a machine can do less than perfect performance. The idea that the machine will be free from any error at all, I may say that we can approximate to that in the machine programmed in advance. But one of the conditions for the self-programming machine is that it can make mistakes.
Well, de la Tille describes the machine which has the built-in memory in the forms of the waves going through the column of mercury, where only once in five does the memory work perfectly. But nevertheless, the machine always gives correct answers because there are several circuits, each of which independently solves the problem, and only when all the circuits compare correctly,
yes,
does the answer come out.
That's quite possible to do, and furthermore, the machines have developed very considerably since the stage of which he's writing. That is, they have better memories than machines, memories which are right a larger part of the time. He himself discussed that. Some of these electronic storage devices are better than the circulating column.
Professor Wiener, when people think about machines and getting machines to do their work for them, aren't they usually ambiguous in their thinking about them?
Ambiguous and ambivalent. By that I mean, what do people want of a machine? They want effective performance, and effective performance may mean something that would be analogous to intelligence in the machine. But you get the machine developed beyond a certain point, and the person controlling it may not be in complete possession of that effective performance, so that to make the machine effectively performing beyond a certain point brings it beyond control. In other words, the machine will act as if it had a will of its own. It's the old Frankenstein problem. It's the old problem of slavery. You want two things in a slave, and you can't get them both. You want intelligence in a slave, and you want the slave to do the things that you want it to do. In other words, you want it to do what you want to do, but what you don't know you want it to do.
Isn't this somehow analogous to the difference between a multipurpose machine and a unipurpose machine?
Most certainly.
The more perfect you get the machine in doing one particular thing, the faster and the better, the less it is able to do anything else.
Definitely.
Whereas if you have a machine that is capable of doing a great many things, it becomes very complicated, and it may not do any of the individual things better than a machine designed to do that one thing alone.
But the complication itself means that the person who has designed it has not fully penetrated what the machine is going to do. The fact that it is a machine does not mean that it's predictable. Predictability is not a thing of the machine alone, but a relation of between the machine and the person who's running it.
Well, de la Tille gives a kind of structure and ascending complexity of machines of different levels of complexity. One of the machines that, he thought was very infrequent was one that was a self-organizing machine on a random basis. Professor Wiener, you were talking before we went on the air tonight about some very interesting experiments that you were doing, which seemed to be an amplification of this.
There's a good deal of work being done on this. I want to say that the first fairly clear idea of this was Ashby's. Then some other papers have come since, which discuss model nervous systems, which imitate the actual nervous system, and in which certain random behavior organizes itself, where the machine not only learns, but learns in a way not programmed, learns by its own failures. But there are other cases where machines or structures, and I'm talking here both about machines and living organisms, do pull themselves together and organize themselves in behavior. Now, one of the simple models for this is a very mechanical sort of a machine, an electric lighting network. You have a lot of generators there. These generators are kept about at the same frequency by governors on the engines that drive them. Now, these have the tendency that when you put a whole lot of these on the same bus bars, there's the same electric connections, that the machines that are going fast take more of the load than the rest. The machines that are going slow take less of the load. The result is they tend to even themselves out, and you have a virtual generator, which is better than the generator of any single, a virtual governor, which is better than the governor of any single generator. The result is that you get the thing organizing itself very accurately into, let us say, 60 cycles. Now, this is the machine end of the thing. But we are finding that in the brain, there's evidence that we also have some systems of oscillators which also tend to pull themselves into phase. And also, while they are about a certain frequency, tend to make a virtual governor, which holds at least a part of the system much more precisely at a given frequency than the individual once can. Self-organizing.
Within the brain itself. Is there anything like that in biology?
Oh, well, of course, the brain is biology, but let us take one very definite example. Now, I am giving here speculation rather than absolutely definite results. Namely, in the formation of the embryo, the heart forms as a lot of contracting cells. These contracting cells, beating cells, as they would go by themselves, would be in a state which we would call fibrillation, each one beating independently of the others. But very soon, they begin to beat as a tissue, as a heart, and pull themselves into an organ. Now, this problem is probably just about the same as that of the electric system. And it shows how mere putting things together, mere arrangement of elements with certain properties, will produce the effect of what is called an organizer.
I might say that this same sort of thing goes on within the cell, too. The cell is controlled by chromosomes. The chromosomes are themselves ordered arrangements of genes, each of which controls some of the chemical substances within the cell, which control its workings. Now, when a cell divides, both daughter cells must be supplied with these chromosomes, and the two must have identical chromosomes. It is therefore incumbent upon each individual chromosome to form another one exactly like itself. It does this by drawing out of the substance of the cell simple compounds, which it will combine into these long strings of genes. And it does in this manner produce a duplicate of itself, creating a greater organization out of lesser organization by virtue of its own organization. It is a self-organizing system. And the interesting thing is that occasionally this self-organization is not perfect. And it is this very imperfection that is of the first importance to life, because of the production of an imperfect chromosome, there is occasionally produced a cell which is superior to the original cell as far as adaptation to its environment is concerned. And as a result of many of these things, we have what is called evolution, the gradual development of organisms to fit their environment, or perhaps better, the gradual elimination of organisms less fitted for their environment.
Well, on a very simple level, at the start of the discussion of cybernetics, you always become involved with the feedback or the servo mechanism.
The feedback, yes.
Now, everything that you have been describing is actually, all of these are examples of a very complicated feedback, aren't they? Much more complicated than de Latil himself points out.
Yes. De Latil thoroughly understands the feedback, but he only discusses it at the simplest stage, what we would call the linear feedback, the sort of organization where inputs added give outputs added.
What's a good example of a simple example of a feedback, Professor Wiener?
Well, supposing I'm driving my car down the street. Now, I don't determine in advance that I'm going to make such a turn at a certain place, such a turn in another place, not at all. What I do is, if I find my car beginning to deviate to the left, I turn it to the right. If I find it beginning to deviate to the right, I turn it to the left. In other words, I keep my behavior organized by a continual correction so that any deviation serves as an input that produces a deviation in the opposite direction or cuts down that deviation.
You wrote a story about an automobile once, didn't you, Professor Eisenhower, called Sally, I think. Was Sally the kind of automobile that worked by feedback?
Yes, it was, and what's more, without the necessity of a human operator, which is what appeals to me. Now, obviously, driving a car is a relatively simple function of the human being. There are relatively few impulses that need be, that the relatively few impacts of the environment upon the human being that are necessary to driving a car. You observe the other cars, you observe the signals, the turns, and so on. It's nothing near as complicated as writing a story, for instance. Now, it should be, theoretically, easy to build a machine which would respond to these impingements of the environment and make its own turns, avoid other cars, and so on. Of course, one would have to instruct the machine first as to which turns it was necessary to make to go to a certain objective. And I skip all the fancy stuff, of course, in my story and deal only with a finished product. I'm leaving the fancy stuff to Dr. Wiener because he says it's simple.
Well, what I say is this, that this scheme of doing things, which is fictional and remote with a car, fictional because it's difficult, fictional because it is not immediately needed to that extent, it's certainly needed in controlled missiles and is coming to be needed in the modern airplane. As a matter of fact, I don't think it will be many years before we will have to have that sort of a device in, to solve our air traffic problem. So that I don't think that this is pure science fiction. I think that it's very near to science fact.
Well, you're referring, of course, to horrible accidents like that which occurred near the Grand Canyon recently.
Yes, but as the traffic increases, horrible potential accidents of that sort are not rarities. And we will have to organize our traffic to contemplate them.
Where airplanes avoid one another.
Where they avoid one another.
Professor Wiener, in the construction of these machines, am I right in believing that there are probably two ways that you can go about it? You could go about it, let's say, empirically, where you might attempt to construct something in an approximation or an analogy to a human network of a nervous system. Then wouldn't there be another way of going about the construction of one of these machines where you would make them or applications of mathematical principles?
You have to do both. On the one hand, you can take the particular construction and try to summarize it by mathematical principles. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you can see general mathematical principles and try to realize them by particular constructions. Science is never a one-way road. There's always an interaction between different approaches.
But as you work on the mathematical basis of the random organization of these nonlinear
systems...
I'm
trying to work on it now, yes.
Okay. Once you arrive at these, wouldn't it be possible to make these mathematical principles operative in any number of machines, which probably...
Without any doubt it would. And that's what happened, of course, with the original feedback notion when the people first began working on that for electronic circuits. But I don't think that we can say that invention or discovery follows a unique track. There's got to be an interaction between suggestions at both ends of the game. On the one hand, you see a machine and you try to see what organization would do it. On the other hand, you see a mathematical theory and you try to see how you can realize it.
Well, what I was getting at was the danger in cybernetics of the limitations of the man seeing things in terms of the man. I mean, you see man, and then you think in terms of machine that might approximate. In other words, there's always a tendency. How does the cyberneticist, if that's the way you make an operative noun out of the term of the science, how does he detach himself enough from his anthropomorphic
thinking?
He's
got to work from both ends. He's got to do what Gray Walter, for example, has done, construct machines that imitate some of the human purposes and see how they behave. On the other hand, he's got to examine human behavior and see what sort of a gadget would do something like that. I mean, he's got to go both from the machine and the man. As a matter of fact, in using the word cybernetics, I definitely said the study of communication and control in the living being and the machine, and I had to bring in both, that the two were interacting, that you neither approach the thing completely from one standpoint or completely from the other.
Well, Professor Asimov, you wrote the introduction to this book, Thinking by Machine, which you make, I think, much of the point that this is a new area of knowledge where one must bring to bear several of the disciplines which up to this time have been independent. What are some of the disciplines or knowledges, for example, that you're bringing to bear in this illustration of the self-organizing material in either the generators or the cell?
Well, Dr. Wiener, I think, in his discussion right here on this program, has already made it quite plain that although he himself is, I think, primarily a mathematician, he yet has to concern himself with the neurons of the brain, the cells of the heart. This is biology. There are applications in the chromosomes and the biochemical organization within the cell. He has taken examples from electrical engineering. When one gets sufficiently broad, one finds that all the various branches of science are man-made partitions of one truth with a capital T, except that I'm not going to define what I mean by truth. one must play it safe. And as a matter of fact, I think that there has been an increasing danger that people will forget that the partitions are man-made and concern themselves with one segment of science, of knowledge, to such an extent that there will be a negative feedback. It will be impossible to progress simply because in order to progress in a particular field, one must have a knowledge of other fields, which one will not have, you see. And I think that the important thing about thinking machines is that it will, in a sense, free the human mind from too great enslavement in limited fields and make it possible, by the help of machines, to once more return to the days where a person could have a general knowledge of science the way, for instance, Leibniz did. And this, I think, will act as a positive feedback by accelerating the advance of science.
I agree with you completely. I don't think that one can build up cooperative research by having a number of people, each work on their own specialty, each march up to the frontier, present arms, turn around and march away again. It is necessary for cooperative research for everybody significantly involved in it, and I mean everybody, to understand what the other person is doing, to have at least a passive and to a certain extent an active participation in the other work. Then you can get real cooperative research that means something. But the idea of a research being done on the pattern of a big company is the worst possible way for doing work with really new ideas.
Really, the assumption behind that kind of cooperative research is that if you were to string beads on a piece of string, at the end you have a unity. Whereas much of this book, a part of it which I don't think we ought to go into, is a statement of the way in which the problem of various effects can be stated mathematically. And unless
Certainly.
You can state these things mathematically, the mathematician cannot really communicate with the philosopher.
It's necessary to go into all the branches of this field. For example, when I'm working with the physiologists on brainwave work, as I'm doing now, I must know how the data are taken. I must know how the instruments are built by which one works up the data. I must know what the troubles are. I must know what the physical analogs are, have them in mind. If I can't do that, I'm hamstrung.
When people think about the machine and the elaborate machines which have been built, they eventually want to ask, I suppose, the question, what are the limitations of the machines that we can build? Or are there any limitations?
Well, obviously, we find it very difficult to ask about things we haven't thought of. To say that the limitations are rigid and specific is a very hard thing to say. One of the misleading things in all this that hampers us tremendously is that the words which we usually use, mechanism or life, are words which fit a particular stage of knowledge and words which have no absolute content. The questions which we most easily ask and seem to be most significant are the questions in many cases which can't be asked at all. If we ask, when we have made a machine which simulates certain phases of life, is this living or not? Is that really a significant question? We can't even answer whether a virus is living or not. I think you could say something about that, sir.
Well, the one thing about a virus which causes us to say that it is living is that within the cell, it will reproduce itself. Not parts of the cell that it is feeding on, but itself. And after the cell dies, there are hundreds of viruses identical with the original one. Outside the cell, there is nothing about the virus we can call alive. So that there it is, right in the boundary line. Incidentally, I would like to say this, that people who ask whether there are any limitations to the machine, I think sometimes use the word limitations as a derogatory term, implying that machines must have limitations just because they are machines, and therefore inferior to, quote, living things, unquote. But everything, by the very nature of its substance, has some sort of limitation. For instance, the human being has the limitation that he cannot fly simply by flapping his arms. Well, there's a limitation. This does not make him less a human being. And it would not make a machine necessarily a lower level because it had a limitation.
There's one thing very interesting. The late Professor von Neumann reflected on this question, whether a machine could reconstruct itself as the virus does, as the living organism. And he pointed out that when you reach a certain degree of complexity, it most certainly could. That is, beyond a certain point, there is no reason why a machine cannot build something more complicated than it is, because the number of combinations of things is greater than
the number
of parts.
Things. Yes. And as a matter of fact, working in the opposite direction, if you get a mass of hydrogen gas of sufficient mass, it will automatically create a star.
Certainly.
Well, listening to you people talk, it's rather a humbling experience for someone who's reading mostly in the humanities. This, to me, was the first book in this area for, let's say, the general reader, with the exception of possibly a few. Professor Asimov, do you know any other books in this area on the same subject?
There is one, really, that affected me as much as this one did, and that was entitled The Human Use of Human Beings by an author whose name I forget, and perhaps you can supply it, Dr. Wiener.
I never happened to meet the gentleman. But I think it's Norbert Wiener.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Wiener and Professor Asimov, for coming tonight. Is there anything that you would like to add, either about the book or about the subject itself? Let's say Professor Asimov first.
Well, there is this. Cybernetics and all the things that are growing out of it is an infant science. It is young. Like all infant sciences, it is very malleable and plastic. People keep getting new ideas about it. It's growing in all directions. And for that very reason, the subject itself may be confusing. It hasn't got this solid background of material one can work on, but all the more promising for the future.
But I'm trying, and other people are trying, to fill it out in just exactly that direction, to develop measuring techniques and idea techniques that can be made more specific than they are now. Measurement techniques and techniques of study of mathematical organization. And I think we are not too hopelessly far from doing just that.
Yeah, I can envisage a future in which the grammar school students will learn how to handle computers before they learn how to memorize the multiplication table. In fact, they may not have to memorize the multiplication table. Why should they? Let the machine memorize it.
Yes, Professor, go ahead.
The trouble is that there are too many of them forgetting how to do their mathematics now and hoping that the machine will do all of it.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Wiener, Professor Asimov. I think that anyone picking up Pierre de Latil's book will find it very intriguing, but if they've been listening tonight, they've also have seen that some of the things that Mr. de Latil was thinking have already been outdated, not by a machine, but by the inventor, actually, of the science, Professor Wiener himself. So thank you very much and good night.
I've been reading Thinking by Machine by Pierre de Latil, published by Houghton Mifflin Company. Here to discuss this book have been Norbert Wiener, Professor of Mathematics, MIT, and Isaac Asimov, Associate Professor of Biochemistry, Boston University School of Medicine. Your I've Been Reading host has been P. Albert Duhamel, Philomathia Professor in the English Department, Boston College. Next week, the book under discussion will be The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard. Joining Mr. Duhamel at that time will be David Bacon, Visiting Lecturer on Clinical Psychology, Harvard, and Associate Professor of Psychology, University of Missouri, and Richard O. Howe, Vice President of the Advertising Agency of Batten, Barton, Durston, and Osborne, and Manager of the Boston office. I've Been Reading is simultaneously recorded for broadcast on WGBH-FM Wednesday at 8 and Sunday at 6, and on WCOP on your AM dial Sunday evenings at 10. This program was produced and directed by Louis Barlow.